family, we're back. Another Saturday edition of Shrugged. We're hanging out with Charlie Engel. We met him in Tahoe this weekend. And holy crap, this guy ran a marathon in the morning, a marathon in the afternoon, for 111 straight days across the Sahara Desert. You know what else is cool is I've watched the documentary that was filmed about his adventure across the Sahara, and I knew that I like kind of knew who this person was, but I didn't really know. And then I met him and I like kind of didn't really, I don't know, like I felt like maybe we had been like friends in some distant past life. And then he told me that he ran the Sahara, and I knew exactly who he was. And then I get really stoked on these things because these people are gangsters that do this thing. Like, two marathons a day? A marathon is just like how he thinks of time. Like, oh, that's about a marathon. Holy crap. Couldn't even imagine. But what is really epic about doing things like this is that when you finish them, you inspire the hell out of a lot of people. And now he has a foundation with Matt Damon, and he's doing really, really cool things. I hope you guys enjoy the interview. I had a blast meeting Charlie. I was not really expecting a lot, mainly because it was like a long distance ultra marathoner, and there's fewer people that I have less in common with than ultra marathoners. I don't understand that at all. And then when I got to know him and we started interviewing him and all the things, man, I was so impressed, and I wish we had like 2.5 hours to talk to him, but we were getting kicked out. He had other things to do because he's a big shot at the Spartan World Championships, and he had to go. But awesome interview. I'm really stoked that we got to meet him, and just what a blast. Make sure you get over to the program vault, shrugcollective.com/vault. 11 programs. You've got 3 long-term programs, Olympic weightlifting. You've got the CrossFits. You've got the mass gains, all the things that you need to get super swole, strong, fast, healthy, all the things. 8 short-term programs. I hope you guys love it. $47 a month, 11 programs. Membership site, shrugcollective.com/vault. Get in there. Hope you enjoy the show.
I'm going to talk to you about
you're
not
on
having a
52
podcast.
Shows a That's year. You basically have your
a
own
podcast
that everyone else pays for. Can you turn me up just a tad?
I'm playing with
I'm
it.
I'm so blown.
Do you know
out.
What,
just,
dude?
Just talk
that
to him for
is,
a second.
That's the goal. That is actually funny.
I'll let you pay for my podcast.
Yeah.
And I'll just talk about whatever I want on your
and
show.
Every week what I do is I post.
Yeah.
The problem is they'd be asking me the same question, so we'd be talking about the same shit every week.
Well, if you're a guest on the show, it's actually more powerful because I'm going to ask you, and I just hang out and learn.
Yeah, and so what
so the
I
goal
am,
is actually to get your message out.
When I come on your podcast,
yeah.
When I come on your podcast, I'm actually interviewing you. I'm talking to you. And then your podcast is it ends up being you, and my podcast ends up
oh,
being
I like
you.
That.
You understand?
You flip the role.
Because otherwise, all I'm doing is 52 weeks a year answering the same question.
Yeah.
Not the same questions, but, you know, in general, what have you done? Who are you?
It turns
you?
In – that's you, the biggest problem with all the podcasting right
after
now.
A while.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could come on and interview the host.
I'm just going to make up some shit today.
Let's do it.
Just to be different.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Now that you've said that means
totally.
The show's ready to start.
100%.
Welcome to Barbell Shrug. My name is Anders Varner. We're at the PodFest. Is that what that's called?
PodFest.
PodFest.
World Championships.
Look, they put all these people that run podcasts in like a cage back here.
Yeah.
Fluorescent lights. It's gorgeous outside. We're in Lake Tahoe, California. Hanging out with Doug Larson.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Engel. You just got off a stage. I think it was a stage.
I did. It
leadership
was.
Talk.
I did. Yeah.
You've got cool. some trail running things kicking off here.
I do. You know, so Spartan is known for obstacle course racing.
Pops up just a little bit.
There
like,
you go.
Just like that.
There
They're
go.
Known for obstacle course racing. But in Joe DeSena's infinite wisdom, you know, of
I've heard that a lot this just in the first 24 hours of being here.
Joe is an idea guy.
That guy's
guy.
Different.
He's an idea guy.
Yeah.
No, he's you know, he's one of those people that puts out the big ideas, and he is he's gotten to a point, I think, in his career, though, where he can throw it out there. So we started talking about Spartan Trail, you know, and just they're known for obstacle course racing. A lot of people don't want to jump over shit and get muddy, you know.
Mm-hmm. They also don't want to run a road race where there's pounding pavement for 26 miles.
Exactly. And, you know, ultra running, which is sort of my background, which I'm sure we'll talk about, ultra running is really where these days, you know, 50 milers, 100 milers, I mean, it's just blown up. They're everywhere. But what's not everywhere, actually, is like a 10K trail race
or
a half marathon trail race. And so that's what Spartan Trail is going to be. So
that's really interesting that that's the case because trail running, in my opinion, like not being a runner, I always really enjoyed trail running.
Yeah.
I'll go for a trail run, no problem.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go for a 10-mile race run just on my own, just going for a jog. But if I'm close to some trails and I'm running around the woods, that sounds awesome. But I can't believe nobody's really pushed this forward and made it a big thing yet.
Trail running's actually become the most fun training that I'm doing probably over the last like 18 months of just my life. I hated running for so long. I hated it because the pavement sucks.
Yeah.
But if you get out into the woods and you breathe, and especially in California in the desert, now it's 110 degrees out there. It's fantastic.
To run from the fires, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, well, the thing is, you know, picture where you run your trails most of the time and then try to picture 800 people being on that trail at one time. It is a little complicated.
Sure,
so you do have to have the right venues. So the cool thing about Spartan Trail is that we're doing it at already existing Spartan venues.
Mm.
So we're not doing it here at Tahoe this year, but my guess is next year we will. And you can just imagine there's, you know, yes, you've got this amazing course right here, but, you know, we could take people off on trails heading the complete opposite direction. You know, we could accommodate a couple thousand
people. Especially here. It's incredible stuff.
So, you know, the goal will be to, of course, to further the Spartan brand, but more than anything, bring people into the Spartan tribe who, you know, who again, are maybe intimidated by having to jump over a wall or doing burpees.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Spartan Trail Race will be true to the brand in the sense that it's going to be, you know, my hope is that it rains a couple of days before the trail race. You know, the first one is actually October 13th in Virginia, in Arrington, Virginia, during, you know, it'll be on that Saturday morning starting at the same time as some of the Spartan races. It's just the trail runners will go off one way and the regular Spartan racers will go off the other way. And, you know, it'll be a cool way. What happens at these races, too, a lot of times is maybe one person in a couple wants to come do the obstacle course race, and very often the other person is athletic.
Yeah.
So this gives, you know, both of them something to do. Also.
You were saying you hope it rains. Was that kind of implying that you guys want this to be something that's not just like a casual trail run? Like you want this to be in line with the Spartan brand. This thing needs to be really, really tough.
Yeah. If somebody does the Spartan Trail half marathon, the last thing I want them thinking about or talking about when they get home is what their time was.
Yeah.
Because who cares? Who cares? I mean, because the course is not going to be some smooth trail. I'm going to be
– Every course is different, I imagine.
People are going to be on rocks and roots and mud and you know, in the eastern half of the United States right now, there's – thanks to the hurricane and other things, there's trees down everywhere. So I just scouted these trails last week, and there's – you know, in a half marathon, you're going to have to go over 10 or 12 over, under, through, you know, some trees and some mud. And you know what? And those are – those are the stories that we want to tell when we're done with something.
It's actually like what brings people, I think, to these events is like they're overcoming this big thing. Like the first one I ever did, I was actually kind of let down because I thought I was going to be jumping over this like gigantic flaming pit. And then I'm not going to name what company that was, but I got to the flame and I was like, I wanted the flame. Where's the big flame? But they come to this, like this, everybody, I haven't done any of these Spartan races.
Yeah.
So this is the very first one, and everybody has literally freaked me out over the last 24 hours about how unprepared I am to go get my ass kicked tomorrow.
Well, you know what? Here's the other thing, though, and I tell people all the time about Spartan, which is something I love so much. Nobody cares how you do.
Yeah.
Except for you. You know, you're basically anonymous. There's 10,000 people here. It's going to be wave after wave after wave. And so when you're out there, you know, it's really just you watching you and you against the course. And, you know, as a runner, my background is running, and I've done pretty well at a lot of big races. And so if I was to finish, you know, last in a big – 100 miler, you know, I'd get 100 messages saying, what's wrong? You know, are you sick? Are you injured? Like, what's happening? If I finish last, like, tomorrow, nobody cares.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I might. And as an athlete, too, though, and I think this is philosophically, this is a really great point, and that is it's safer for me to go do a run, right? I mean, it's way safer for me to go do a marathon or a half or a 50 miler or something in the trails.
Just because you have a background in ultras.
I know I can do that, right? So when I step out here tomorrow, you know, what do I actually have to gain? Well, what I have to gain is this. You know, my belief is, you know, surviving anything, getting through difficult things isn't about being, you know, the same person you were at the end of it. Like, especially if it's self-inflicted suffering. Yeah. I mean, we're choosing to do this race. Yeah. Nobody's forcing us, right?
Totally.
So maybe somebody's forcing you guys. I don't know. But, you know, so you're choosing to do
Doug's the race. Doug's making me do
I'm
it.
Making Anders do it.
That's right. So you can't very well blame anyone.
He intentionally told me
other.
To not be prepared.
Right.
Don't worry about the goo packs. No big deal. You'll be fine without any carbohydrates.
Just my only piece of advice, just start slow and taper off.
That's what everybody says. Start slow and taper off. That's great.
Pretend you're hiking for like the first 2 hours. Hours.
Yeah.
But what, you know, what you want at the end of this thing, you know, you whether you realize it or not, but I know you guys do, you know, you want to be empty at the end of this thing. Like you want to cross that finish line and actually be thinking, not just thank God that's over, which will absolutely be one thought, but also, you know, that it took everything you had to get through it. And it's cliche, but that you left everything out there. And it's just, you know, people avoid, you know, they avoid hardship way too often. Comfort is so overrated. We don't learn anything from comfort. And this is controlled, safe suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to go out here, you're not going to die. You know, no matter how badly it goes, it will make you a better person. It will make you have a greater understanding of yourself. And humility is good for all of us.
Right.
And it's fun to watch really amazing. Some of the people you'll see tomorrow, you just won't freaking believe how easy they make this stuff look.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually think at the extremes, being too physically comfortable isn't good for your mental health. I think there's, especially like you said, this is self-inflicted physical suffering. Like, we're doing this, we're choosing to actively, you know, no one's making us do it. I think consciously doing things like this is really good for people's mental and emotional health, just as it's good for their physical health. Like, if you're pushing yourself to the limit, then it's very hard not to be present and engaged in that moment where you're not thinking about your bills, and you're not thinking about the, you know, whatever conflict might be in your life, or, you know, the person who, you know, is sick that you hope is doing better. Like, you're just present in that moment when you're truly pushing yourself. Especially when you're outdoors, you're in the sun, you're around people that you really enjoy being around, you know, run the race with Anders and a couple of friends tomorrow. Like, it's hard for me to not be thinking about anything except for exactly what I'm doing in that moment. I think that's really good for people's emotional and mental health.
Well, you said that incredibly well, and it's this idea that we spend so much of our lives trying to control everything, right? Because we do have bills and we have families and you have a schedule, and like, you guys have stuff to do and you need to try to stick to that. So much of it is about control. And when the gun goes off tomorrow and you do your yells in the starting corral and you get into this mindset, the second you step away from that start line, you're out of control.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you really are. You are no longer in control. And that's such a, you know, being able to thrive in chaos and randomness is really I think it's the greatest strength that we can develop. And yet so many people, you know, try to arrange their lives in a way where everything is controlled and there's very little that happens that's random. And if it does, it throws them off.
Yeah.
You know, at work, I tell people regularly too, you know, you should actually hope for, you know, a shakeup in management. Or how else are you going to differentiate yourself from other people. Like, if that's what you need to do to progress in what you're doing, if things aren't chaotic.
There has to be chaos to be able to weave through something, or it's too structured, too systematic.
If everybody's doing great, you're gonna be stuck right where you are.
One more rung up on that ladder.
Yeah.
But all this stuff kind of came, this overcoming adversity thing was not just like something you found out on the mountain. Like, your whole platform is built off of kind of overcoming addiction recovery.
It is. So, I mean, I'll give you the short version, but in my I went to college at UNC Chapel Hill as a 17-year-old freshman a long time ago, and, you know, I had that that sort of dream-like high school career, you know, captain of the sports teams and top 10 in my class and, you know, dated the cheerleaders and, you know, I was the man. And so I get to college and
He still is. He's still dating cheerleaders.
Cheerleaders love him.
Yes. He actually has a whole harem of cheerleaders behind us right now. You just can't see it.
Only when my wife lets me.
Yeah.
Which is occasionally, I'm happy to say.
All right. I still dabble in cheerleaders.
You're doing it right.
But, you know, I get there and I it's like I fully expect there to be a banner on the dorm that says, you know, welcome Charlie.
Yeah.
You know, and after about a week, what I actually figured out was just how freaking average I was.
Yeah.
Like, there's 4,000 other freshmen there who have the exact same resume,
yeah,
you know, that I did. And what I found, though, was I was like an incredible all-American first team drinker. And that's the path.
One thing good about college, they will let you drink forever. Yeah.
That's the
There's
path
no stopping
I chose.
You.
No, and so that's where I went, and needless to say, it wasn't good for you know, a really successful college career. But, you know, I ended up from 19 to 29. You know, I'm old enough that basically it was, you know, the 80s were the cocaine decade. I mean, it was pretty much ubiquitous. It's still out there, but it was sort of like the, you know, it was everywhere, you know, and I was an addict, and I was a very high achieving guy. You know, I led every company during my 20s, you know, in sales, because as an addict, you know, I needed to do that so that I could balance on this side, and people couldn't say, well, look what a screw up you are.
Was this like a weekend thing a Tuesday afternoon lines?
No, I was. Yeah. So any opportunity, you know, if there was a chance.
At some level, it's like performance enhancing when you're in sales.
Absolutely.
You are on fire.
Absolutely. Totally. No, I mean, it's an inevitable crash, and that crash happened over and over again. And my joke used to be that, you know, well, the boss can't fire the best salesman. And that absolutely turned out not to be true. eventually everybody has had enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, quitting, as I like to say, quitting was easy. I did it 100 times.
Yeah.
You know, totally. So I quit over and over and over. That's the last time. I'm never going to do that again. And then I'll just cut to the chase. So I'm my first son was born when I was 29 years old. And, you know, I actually counted on him to be my savior. Like, he was going to save me, because this was finally going to be this human being that was going to count on me to actually be a dad and a person and all that. So I couldn't possibly continue this destructive behavior. And, you know, a couple of months into it, I had done well, and my wife at the time, his mom, and my son Brett came to visit me. I was on a job in Kansas, and they came and spent a week, and it was like the most amazing week of my life. You know, I know you have kids. You have kids also?
13-week-old.
Yeah. Oh, well, look who I'm talking to.
Right?
So, you know,
I'm learning all this right now.
So you're holding this little baby,
little nugget.
And like, it makes you want to, you just, like, I'm getting goosebumps now just thinking about it. And I have this place where, as an addict, you know, I just thought I was broken. And I have this place where I now have all this love to give. And I feel this, you know, completely unbiased, unjudging love coming back from this little baby. So I'm never going to use again. I take my wife and my son, and I drop them off at the airport in Wichita after the best week of my life, and I drive straight to the hood, and I spend the next 6 days smoking crack and killing myself. And it was like, that was when I realized nobody...
Yo, hold on. Crack is a really aggressive jump.
Indeed. Indeed.
That was a switch that just happened. From
hold on a second, crack. I am cocaine is like a thing that people, like, you're if you're in a circle, you've probably seen that before.
Yeah.
Going to the hood and finding crack, when does that step happen? Because that's like you're like, oh, fuck, I made it to the crack house.
I'll tell you exactly when it happens. It happens when you travel, as I did for a living, and you go out on the streets looking for drugs, basically, and finding, powder cocaine from your, from your local dealer that you've bought from for years is no problem. But, if you're going to show up in some strange city, the place to go is, I'd always say, where should I go in this city? Not for drugs, but like, and people would say, there's this great bar over here. But whatever you do, don't go down to, Colfax in Denver. Don't go down there.
Where I'm going.
Right. I'm like, just so I'm sure where to stay away from. Can you tell me where that is exactly?
Does Uber go there?
And so that's where it was a much easier drug to get, and it was cheap, and it was awful. And unfortunately, the second I tried it, it became, it's like it planted a flag in my brain and claimed that territory. And it's awful. It's awful. And I mean, what's happening today in the country is a similar thing with so many people in their 20s, especially, and teenagers. This opioid fentanyl crisis is like the real deal.
Yeah.
And it's cheap and it's easy to get, and it's like just it's awful. But anyway, so I am in Wichita, and at the end of 6 days, I'm sitting on the ground outside of a dumpy, like motel that I $15 a night that I can no longer pay for, I'm watching the police go through my car, and there's three bullet holes in the car, and it's from somebody shooting at me. Like, it wasn't they weren't shooting at my car. Like, they were shooting at me, and it really was one of those moments, or the moment.
Why were they shooting at you?
Just drug deal. I had money. One of the things you keep.
I've never been shot at, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's not good. I had one go right into the driver's door, and it like grazed my pants.
Yeah.
It was real, and I'm watching this. When I knew I was in trouble, I'm watching this cop, sort of search my vehicle, and he reaches under the seat, and he pulls out this crack pipe, and, and he holds it up, and he, like, turns around and looks at me and shakes his head, and that moment of just such painful judgment and embarrassment and humiliation for me, yet all I could really think of about was, like, so that's where that was.
Yeah.
Like,
damn,
I looked for that thing for an hour.
Yeah.
And
frantically.
I don't mean to make light of it, but that was when I said, okay, I have a choice. I have a choice between living and dying right now. And I chose running is what I chose.
Yeah. What are some
wait,
of
wait,
the...
Wait, yeah. wait, let's back up for a second. Did you end up spending time in jail or prison as a result of him finding that? Or what happened with that?
No, and I mean, not to go off on a tangent, if I was, if I'd been African-American, I certainly would have. But, not to go too deeply down that social. Yeah, but I was a still moderately clean cut white guy, driving through the hood in a Toyota 4Runner, and it was a double standard, completely. Yeah. And there really wasn't anything, technically I didn't commit a crime that they witnessed. Having drug paraphernalia, they certainly could have, and actually they may have written me like a ticket, but for that there was nothing they could have really done about it. And and thankfully,
do you tell your wife about that right away, or is that like, I'll just keep that to myself?
By that point in my marriage, and that was my first marriage, by that point, she knew. When I basically fell off the face of the earth for 2, 3, 4 days at a time, we were way beyond her wondering what I was doing. And it was terrible. It was a terrible way to live, and unsustainable. The best part about it, and it sounds crazy to say it this way, is that I learned about true suffering during 10 years of addiction. Yeah. And everything that's come after that, even some really shitty things, pale in comparison to, just the depths of laying there in a bed after a 4-day binge, knowing you know, spent all my family's money and my money, and you know, I've just destroyed myself again, and I have to start over again, and I have to tell all these people, I promise I'll never do that again, you know, and I mean it.
Yeah.
That's the thing about an addict, you know, when you're in that moment, that terrible moment, you mean it when you say, I'm never doing that again, because why would you?
Yeah.
Who would voluntarily crush themselves in that way and humiliate themselves? But 3 days later, you feel good again. It's like, well, you know, I can just have two beers, despite the fact that in, you know, 10 years of drinking, I've never had just two beers, you know, but I still, but that's what the addict brain says.
When you kind of look back on that, like what, I guess, what were you missing in your life that you were filling with the drugs?
Yeah. No, it's a great, it's a, it, you know, it is a hole. And I think part of it is, certainly genetic. I was a good solid fourth generation, you know, alcoholic addict. And there is a lot of science that says that there is certainly a genetic aspect to it. It doesn't mean if you're, you know, parents or grandparents were that you're going to be, but you certainly, like any disease, you have a greater likelihood.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't know. You know, I grew up an only child in a pretty bohemian sort of hippie household with super young parents, 18 years old. And you know, I spent my life, my early life, trying to figure out how to be relevant, how to be somebody. And I found, you know, I found that drugs, what they did is they so when I started running, and then we're going to start talking about that in a second, when I started running, I sort of ran like an addict, too.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, because I feel like so many people attack fitness in the similar way of, and we kind of come from this CrossFit side of strength and conditioning, and it's not too hard to find people that you're like, hold on, you need to back this thing down a little bit and find a little
and
bit
I'll
of
bet,
balance in
and
your
I'll
life.
And I'll bet some of them were, you know, had been alcoholics or addicts, or, and they make that change and that switch flips.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spent the first 3 years of my running after I finally quit drinking and doing drugs, running like a maniac. I mean, I ran 30 marathons. I ran, and people said, you know, didn't you just, it seems like you just switched addictions.
Is there a similarity kind of between the two highs? Like, I have a really, really good friend of mine that actually had a near-death experience from an overdose and started running as soon as she kind of got healed and out of recovery. And it's a very similar story in that, like, running kind of replaces that thing, and then Are the highs very similar, and kind of the struggle that you go through in that?
Absolutely, but there's a huge distinction, and people have said, you know, when someone says, "Aren't you just addicted to running now?" Very often, especially early on, I took great offense to that because I felt like they were saying, you know, "Aren't you still a fuck up?" Basically, that's what I heard.
Yeah, right.
You know, you're still that same person, and now, you know, you're still just, you know, you just put it all here. But it took me a little while to figure it out. You know, as a runner, well, as an addict, my goal was to be invisible. I wanted to feel nothing. I wanted to hide.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted, was to not be noticed and not feel anything. As a runner, it could not be any more opposite. So while I may have, especially in those early years, I may have run sort of addictively, I felt everything, because there's nowhere to hide. You're going out to run a marathon or a 100-miler, when you hit that, and doing CrossFit too, you know, when you hit the, you know, seventh set of, you know, squats, there's no hiding anymore. I don't care what, you know, I don't care what drug you have in your system. I don't care if you were, you know, drunk out there. You know, like, there's nowhere to hide any longer from that pain. And that was illuminating for me. Like, I loved that.
Well, when people say things like that, like, you were addicted to cocaine and now you're addicted to running, like, when I think about addiction, one of the defining aspects of addiction that I've heard is that you continue to do something despite all the negative outcomes it's producing. And the negative outcomes that running was producing for you was probably not even anywhere in the same ballpark that the from the negative outcomes that you're experiencing.
I never got
to
fired
cocaine.
Because of running.
Right. And no one shot you?
And I could always find my car. After a night of running, I never one time lost my car. Whereas after a whole lot of binges, I would walk out of some place going, where in the hell did I park? Yeah. And why don't I even have my key?
Even if you're running with some level of compulsion, like, it's still not I wouldn't think about it as being addicted in the same way at all.
I have something that I think you'll appreciate, though, too, and that is this. And I ran those years, those early years. Every single time I ran as hard as I could. What I was trying to do in hindsight was, like, run the addict out of me. I wanted to – if I could have taken a knife and just literally – like, if I could find it, I would have sliced that part of me out and discarded it. It took me those years to realize that, in fact, the addict, like, that part of my personality is all the best parts of me.
Yeah.
Like, if I didn't have that, all of a sudden I'd be some blob over in the corner with a remote control in my hand or a video game console, you know, doing nothing but that all day, every day.
Yeah.
And so the gift of still behaving somewhat like an addict, but again, without all the incredibly negative consequences, allowed me to learn. It helped me learn moderation. What I also found was humility, in that, like, I was a good runner. I was breaking 3 hours in the marathon and all of that. So I always tell people, you know, so I was running like 250 marathons, and so when I would go to Boston, that meant like I was 700th.
Yeah.
So it's not like all of a sudden I was like winning the Boston Marathon. Yeah. You know, I was still
It's
anonymous.
Like your college career, though. It's like you get to college and all of a sudden it's like, oh, everybody's smart.
Yeah.
Everybody's fast.
Yeah.
And then you go to the Boston Marathon. It's like, oh, everyone's really, really fast.
Yeah.
But now you have the actual coping mechanisms to kind of deal with that a lot better than going to the bar.
Well, and then what I found out almost accidentally is, you know, with the really longer stuff, once I started entering 50 milers and 100 milers and multi-day races. Yeah. And
so you started,
like,
you did crack again.
Right.
Just on the trail. Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. And what I figured out in those cases, though, was that all of a sudden the playing field was very much leveled for me.
Yeah.
Like, and again, this is totally, I'm looking at you two guys, and I couldn't lift, you know, a quarter of what you guys do. But if we picked a lighter weight and said, okay, let's see who can do 1,000 reps, I would then have at least a chance of, you know, there would come a point where you guys would be way ahead or, you know, whatever, and then it would probably slowly come that way, and maybe I'd even manage it. But I need something to be awful and difficult, and when I enter a race, I actually want – And like, you guys will get you'll get this wish for yourselves tomorrow at this Spartan race. I want at some point to want to quit.
Yeah.
Like, I want to reach that point where I'm done. I'm just done. Yeah. And then find a way to continue moving.
Well, and talking to a bunch of people around here, it was kind of like the progression of it always starts in, like, a physical capacity. And then there's a mental component to it of, like, having to push forward. And then one of the girls yesterday that I was talking to kind of started to get a little bit emotional of, like, the spiritual journey that she kind of goes through on the mountain, and seeing people struggling, overcoming their own adversities, getting through the obstacles. And it was a really, like, being my first one that I'm going to do tomorrow, it's a very cool thing to see that people are able to kind of use this thing that is this Spartan thing and really find themselves out on the mountains, because we're not, like, you talk about being comfortable, like, we're super comfortable in our daily lives, and we have to go find these events to really test our own merit and find out, like, what we're capable of doing.
Well, I'll ask you, I got a question for you. So when is the last time that you can identify that you tried something this new, when you had a first like this?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe it happened last week. But
yeah.
I don't know. But, like, is there something that you could say that you've done?
Yeah, I actually try to do things like this all the time.
Okay.
As much as possible. But it's only, like, so when I was really heavy into the CrossFit thing, there was no way I would look at this and be like, this is stupid. Why would I ever run?
I'm going to mess up my CrossFit.
Yeah, exactly. But since I've been done competing, yeah, like, I try and find as many things as possible, because I learning is like the coolest thing in the world to me now.
And well, the hardest part for you tomorrow, and I mean for both of you, I and you guys seem like you're very aware guys though, is you're going to be jacked up tomorrow and all that. And what I always tell people when they're take a step back, I actually believe that we all sort of live our lives chasing firsts, right? First girlfriend, first car, first job, first, you know, we love, and for me, first drug. Like I basically spent 10 years chasing that first high because nothing is ever like that again. And you really can't recreate it exactly because it's new and you don't know what to expect. So you guys get the beauty tomorrow of doing something that is, not foreign to you because you do. This is a lot about strength and agility and stuff that you're used to, but combined with running and a mountain and a lot of other people. Yeah. And if you can be fully present as much as possible and really appreciate almost in a meditative way, you know, what you're going through and where you are and taking that even just 60 seconds before the race begins and a few deep breaths and look around and just you know, pull in all that energy. It's powerful.
The idea of like the sportsman is almost something that I really almost have started to like. It's like, oh, let's go run 13 miles up a mountain. Okay, I'm so unprepared for tomorrow, which I didn't even know about. But when people like say these things, it's like, okay, cool. Like, I'm in good shape. Yeah. I'd like to do that. Are you doing other events, or is running still kind of the center, and then Spartan clearly has its obstacles and things, but OCR and running, is that still your main?
It is, absolutely. And you know, I still, we were talking before we started today about a big project I have coming up, so a lot of the things I'm doing are sort of in support of that these days, and I'll tell you about that. But for the most part, I like to run, you know, I like to run ultras, and I like to...
How many have you done?
Oh, man. I've probably done 75 ultras.
Have you done what's like the 200, what's like the gnarliest distance that we've...
So these days, actually one of the latest things has been these 200-mile races, actually right where we are. There's one called the Tahoe Rim Trail.
Cool.
And it's literally a 200-mile foot race around Lake Tahoe. And I've not done that one, but it's 200 is the new 100, apparently.
Yeah.
So a race that I've done a lot is there's a race called Badwater, which is in Death Valley in July.
Oh, yeah.
Every year. And
you guys are sick.
I've done that one.
You're
a bunch
twisted
of times.
People doing out there. Yeah. There's no air.
Yeah.
It's just hot.
No, it's just hot.
You have to wear the, like, 4-inch shoes.
200-degree surface temperatures. And
terrifying.
And, you know, the thing is, though, like, if you're going to do something, right, why not maximize? And it's funny. I tell the story very often about early in my running career, I thought for sure I would be that guy who did like 150 marathons, and I'd be the old guy kind of leaning to the left and crooked, and you know, I'm 80 and I'm still running marathons. And I was totally satisfied with that like image of me. I'm thinking this is awesome. And I reached a point though where I realized I got to the start line, and sure, there's this idea if you step up to the start line, if you're trying to like run your best time, like there's a challenge in that. But I got to the start line knowing like I'm gonna finish this race. It might take me 3 hours, it might take me 4 hours, it might, you know, depends on how my day goes. But I missed that feeling of not knowing if I could do it. Like, I mean, the cool thing is for you guys about tomorrow, you're both, you know, tough strong guys, and I have no doubt you'll get to the finish line. My guess is you have a little doubt that you'll get to the finish. I don't know if you do or not, but
I don't know.
But what a great, oh man, that's like the best feeling to step up to something and not know.
Yeah.
And
it's less like I wonder if I'll get to the finish line. It's like I'm very confident I'll get to the finish line barring like a catastrophic injury.
Sure.
But it's more like how is it going to go? Like, it's not going to be easy, but how hard is it going to be? It's going to be hard, but how hard is like the big question. You know, like, how cold am I going to be? Like, what's the weather going to be like? Like that type of thing. I'm not used to that aspect of it. Like, what do I wear? Like, am I going to be super hot? I'm in the sun and it's 75 degrees out, but now I have like long pants and I'm fucking just sweating my balls off. Or is it going to be actually end up raining and we're in the mountains and now we're in the shade and we just like went swimming in ice cold mountain water and I'm just like for like the next 3 hours, like just freezing cold. Like, those are the unknowns that are more interesting to me than the fact that I just have to run for a couple hours.
That's a great, I mean, you guys have the life experience and you've done plenty of hard things. I appreciate the value in doing that. And I mean, that's what I always encourage people to do, is like, what are you waiting for?
Yeah.
Like, what is it? Like, if you want to get into CrossFit, get into CrossFit. What?
Do it.
What are you going to, you got to get in shape to get into CrossFit, or you got to get in shape to start training for a marathon? Screw that. You know, just
start.
Just start. I mean, and if you go run your first marathon, or if, you know, whatever happens tomorrow, I actually guarantee that you guys will, you know, you'll thrive. Yeah. You'll not be the same at the end.
Well, you got some big projects coming up. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to hear about the training, because this adventure you're about to go on is pretty epic.
Yeah,
awesome.
My pleasure.
We'll be back in a sec.
All right.
Shrug fam, I told you, this guy's a gangster. 2 marathons a day. That's insane. And he used to do crack. Yeah, used to do crack. I don't know which one's more intense. I couldn't even imagine doing crack. Scariest thing ever. Starbucks coffee is a lot for me to handle. Crack, I couldn't even fathom. Terrifying, but love it when people turn their lives around. Very cool. Muscle Gain Challenge. You want to get super swole? 26 pounds, 26 weeks. That's the goal. Mass Gain Challenge. Muscle Gain Challenge. Sorry. Get over to the MuscleGainChallenge.com. Download the free ebook, How to Get Strong Now. See, we make things super simple for you, right? You want to get strong now? Okay. I'll write the ebook called How to Get Strong Now. Then you read it, then you do the Muscle Gain Challenge, then you get yoked. 26 pounds, 26 weeks, biceps the size of Arnold's, quads the size of Pekulski's, mouth the size of mine. Yeah, right, good luck. There's no ebook for that. That's a lifetime of dedication. Get over to the MuscleGainChallenge.com right now. Download the free ebook, How to Get Strong Now. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Barbell Shrugged. We are hanging out with Charlie Engel. You have some really epic adventures coming up in your life, but in
Wait a minute. Let's back up for a second.
Yeah, in the break, you just told us that you ran across the Sahara Desert. And we...
Wait, well, like, hasn't everyone?
Sahara Desert?
Yeah, so...
Wait, did they make a documentary about you?
Indeed.
I've watched you.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Running the Sahara.
That's it.
You're on Netflix.
That's me.
I know you now.
Yeah.
That's so radical. This literally just became like the coolest day ever. I've only had this happen to me twice. We were interviewing one of the very first shows I ever did. We were interviewing this guy named Ben Pekulski.
Uh-huh.
And I was literally like... I know you, dude. Like, why do I know you? Like, the whole time I was just sitting there like, have we hung out before? And then, like, halfway through the interview, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm most known for being in Generation Iron 2. And I was like, oh, you don't know me, but I've watched that movie like 12 times. I have totally watched you running the Sahara.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
now we have some stuff to talk about.
Right.
Let's go.
That was a bad idea.
I'm totally watching that when I get home.
Oh, yeah. We can watch it tonight. It's awesome.
Okay. I'm game.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, tell us about that real quick.
Yeah. So, you know, the Sahara came around because another weird note about my background is, so I worked in television production for a number of years, and I was...
What haven't you done?
Man, I was a producer.
Who are you?
I was a shooter and producer on Extreme Makeover Home Edition, if you ever used to watch that show.
I know about that. I didn't watch it, but
yeah. Anyway, but I was running a tremendous amount, doing a lot of races, and... I did this race in the Amazon jungle where a guy that was out there.
Amazon jungle.
Check. Sahara Desert. Check.
This guy just randomly said, hey, I wonder. He had been to the Sahara Desert doing a 100-mile race like the year before. And he's like, I wonder if anybody's ever run all the way across the Sahara. And I literally looked at him and said, that is the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Like, why?
Sign
it's impossible.
Me up.
Like, you can't.
There's no water.
You can't do that. There's no water. You can't. Yeah, all the reasons. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I got home and I researched and I figured out that, you know, as it turns out, for pretty good reason, no one ever had run across the Sahara. And so.
Well, the Sahara Desert's like as big as a, like.
Yeah.
It's like a.
Who knew Africa was that big? Who knew Africa was that big?
You could put like the whole U.S. on Sahara Desert.
Yeah. Yeah, the map,
I don't know if that's true, but it's very big.
No, it's 5,000 miles.
Yeah, the map makes Africa look like it's kind of like the same size as like America.
Yeah.
Not even close.
No,
you could put all the continents probably like in Africa.
Yeah. It's 1.5 times or even twice. The whole continent twice as big as, you know, it's just huge. It's
yeah.
Huge. So I start planning this thing and you know what I started doing was really just telling people. And I think this is a powerful thing, hopefully for some of your listeners and for you guys. Saying something out loud is a whole lot different than thinking about it, right?
You gotta talk about it.
Started,
makes it real.
Yeah. I started telling people, I'm going to be the first person to run across the Sahara Desert. And I had done enough wacky things up to that point that people weren't, that you couldn't totally discount me.
Yeah.
But most of them were like, you're insane. You can't do it. It's not possible. It's too hot. You can't get resupplied. The sand's too deep. All the reasons.
Did you ever make like a cool joke? You're like, oh, I'm going to go on this like soft sand run. Because like living at the beach, people are like, oh, yeah, I went on like a soft sand run. Yeah, across the Sahara.
Yeah. Well, a friend of mine actually said one of my most memorable lines of someone ridiculing me was he said, why don't you just say you're going to swim to the moon? But anyway, I ultimately kept talking about it. And, you know, it's a weird thing when you take possession of an idea and you're surrounded by people, even your friends. And this is actually a serious comment. You can't assume that everyone actually supports what you're doing. It's a strange, you know, like human nature thing because, and I'll flip it over to addiction. When I got sober, my initial instinct was like to get all my drunk friends and try to get them sober too. Look at this amazing new life that I have. And they're like, they're like, piss off.
Yeah, they're like, fuck off.
Right. Jerk.
And right. And so, but
overachiever.
But you think you're better than us?
Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, so years later, of course, as I'm sober and my life is actually, you know, livable as compared to what it used to be, many of those guys and girls came to me and said, you know, I want to change my life because. It is a better life. So running the Sahara, I let other people take sole possession of the impossibility of it, you know, and every time someone told me it wasn't possible, I felt myself dig in and I was at least going to continue to do whatever I could to make it happen. And I won't give you the long version of the story, but I actually...
No, you can.
Well, I managed to get...
I've watched the whole documentary.
Managed to get a meeting with a guy named James Maul, who was a director who had won the Academy Award for Best Documentary a couple years earlier, and for a totally different kind of film. And I got a meeting with him, and I was late, and my pitch sucked, and it was just like the worst thing ever. I'm sweating all over his office, and
how could your pitch suck? Hey, I'm going to run the Sahara Desert.
Yeah. But to ask someone to spend money on that is a little
I'm going to need $1 million.
Right, usually the answer I get is, okay, you go do it and film it and then bring it to
us,
right?
They make these things called GoPros. Have fun.
but at the end of the meeting, I thought maybe I could get a student director or somebody that he could recommend that might get on board this project. And at the end of the meeting, he stood up and put out his hand and said, I'll do it. And I'm like, what do you mean you'll do it? He's like, yeah, you know, if you run across the Sahara, I'm going to be there with cameras. And a week later, he called me and he said, you know, I told you that we needed to get a production company on board. And I just hung up with Matt Damon. And, you know, Matt said that he would like to executive produce this project and he'd like to narrate the film. Is that okay with you? And I paused.
Do you, mind? Do you know that guy? Are you talking about the Good Will Hunting guy? Right. Okay.
I paused.
What's Ben up to? Ben Affleck, is he around?
I'm telling you, dude, I paused and for a fact and I said, well, I was really hoping for somebody better.
Yeah.
But Matt Damon would be all right.
Yeah.
So, you know, you flash forward and now I all of a sudden have two Academy Award winners attached to this thing, and ultimately,
it's a great documentary.
Ultimately, Hans Zimmer did the score for the film, and like he's the greatest, you know,
I watched
music
his documentary
guy,
too. Cause he's a beast,
amazing. And so I got, you know, three Academy Award winners attached to a running film, and just Yeah. I'm freaking out because look,
awesome.
If a sponsor asked me, are you sure you can do this? I'm like, absolutely, 100%, no doubt. If like one of my friends or family said, are you sure you can do this? I'm like, hell no, I'm not sure. How could I be sure that I can run 5,000 miles across the world's biggest desert? So I sucker all these people to come out there with me, including two fellow runners, a Taiwanese friend of mine that I'd raced against a lot, and a Canadian buddy of mine. And so the three of us, you know, I dragged this crew of 20 people out to Senegal in West Africa in the Sahara. And I remember sitting there before we started, the day before, thinking, you know, we're all going to die out here and this is my fault. And why did I think this is a good idea? And, you know, we take off the next day, and actually things go very, very badly pretty much right from the start. And actually, I bet you guys can relate entirely to this, because you know that feeling like if you were going to start CrossFit today, or you watch other people who have been good at something come into CrossFit and they just are on fire, right?
Yeah.
The first two or three days, like, oh my God, this is amazing, and I'm going to set records and all of this, and then that slow descent of the body starts to happen, because I don't care who you are, you will break down.
Yeah.
You know, and so we were out there running 30, 40, 50 miles a day in that first week, trying to basically adapt to that physical stress, and it was 140 degrees, and we're in
your
deep
feet are
sand,
blistered out.
And it's just, so my two running partners are both, you know, I look like day seven, they both have IVs in, and two crew members have quit.
I was going to say, what is the crew doing?
So their job would be, and most of them were native Tuaregs, like the people of the Sahara. So we hired
so they were like laughing
outfitter.
At you. Oh, you think it's hot?
Right.
140.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Wait till it's 160 tomorrow. Right.
So the outfitter, their job was like, you know, go set up a camp for lunch. Because, I mean, look, running was our job.
Yeah.
Like to think that I'm going to run 50 miles, you know, through deep sand over 12 or 14 hours and then pitch my own tent and make my own meal was not really doable. So, you know, our job was to run. And so we had a crew out there because it was a calculated risk. I mean, it was a very risky ordeal in a general sense, but I didn't want to die. I mean, I didn't want to, you know,
I knew it was a chance.
Yeah. You know, without crew, without support.
Were you committed to it enough to a point where it's like, man, this is something that literally could kill you.
And
you have to go into it knowing that that's a possibility.
What was interesting is I ultimately ended up not being afraid of the elements, the heat, the sand, the stress of all of that. But people are dangerous.
Yeah.
And we encountered, you know, we ran across Senegal, Mauritania, which is an Islamic Republic, Mali, Niger, Libya, and Egypt, which, of course, you couldn't run across any of those countries today. None of them. I mean, the world has changed in the 8 years or whatever it's been since I did that. And we encountered, you know, people and, you know, three runners sometimes without our support team, because the support team would go ahead maybe 5 miles and, you know, we'd run and we'd catch up and, you know, drink and eat and then keep going. And every day was about 50 miles of this sort of yo-yoing.
Insane number.
You know, we made it. We ran 111 consecutive days of two marathons a day without taking a single day off.
It's a phenomenal documentary.
How do your feet survive that?
You know, you really do adjust. You adapt. And we weren't racing. So if I felt something going on, if I felt a hot spot, is the way we call it in ultra running, if I felt a hot spot, it's not like I would stop. And I would figure out what's going on with that shoe or that sock, or if I needed to tape something or whatever. Because if you let same in CrossFit or anything else, you let a tiny thing go for long enough, it will become a big thing.
It's a full injury.
Yeah.
Being on the soft sand for the whole thing, is that something that's actually much easier on your joints, but it's harder as far as energy expenditure?
It's a great way to put it. Eventually, it was easier on the joints because, yes, it was softer certainly than running on a road. Mm-hmm. But you think about it. We actually very often in our workouts, we look for, like on a BOSU ball or something like that, we look for ways to create instability in order to strengthen the supporting muscles. You know, you're working one big muscle group, but of course all those little supporting tendons and muscles, yeah. You need those. So in the Sahara, we had no choice but to strengthen those, yeah. Because every step was like, you know, yeah. you're never just hitting solid ground.
What does your training look like as you're going up to that? I mean, I part of the thing that really makes me, I think is really cool is when you start talking about it. Because as soon as you start talking about it, then you have to start taking action to, okay, yeah. Now I backed myself into this corner. I'm telling everybody I'm going to go run the Sahara. No one's ever done this thing before, yeah. And shit, now I got to start training. Yeah. How do you train for the Sahara Desert?
You know what, though? It is like it's life. You know, I had been running for a long time by that point, and I'd been sober, so 92. I'd been sober like 13, 14 years when I did that, and you know, and life is training, right? I mean, you actually can't go out and train your body for that because it would be unhealthy.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't ever represent the fact that trying to run 50 miles a day for over 100 days is, I don't say this is what you should do.
If
to
you
be
can't
healthy.
Do that, you're out of shape.
Right. So
it's really good for you.
I gained like 15 pounds before I started the run because I knew what would happen. And yeah. I'll never forget Gatorade was one of our big sponsors. And so I went to the Gatorade Sports Science Labs, and they're like doing all these tests and glucose testing.
Can you put more sugar in the drink, please?
Right, sweat.
Like, I need more.
Right, they're doing sweat tests, and I'll just never forget meeting with this nutritionist, and she goes, okay, by my calculation, you're going to burn, you know, you need to take in about 12,000 calories a day in order to maintain your weight. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I remember looking at her like going, okay, you understand that basically I have couscous and goat to work with, right? And so I managed about 4,000 calories a day on average, you know, for sometimes maybe as much as 5. So of course I lost weight, but you guys can attest to this. The human body is just
crazy.
An amazing machine because it adapts to the stress.
What did heat feel like by the end?
Yeah, well, we tried all kinds of things. That we had a medical doctor along with us, and he was I told him before this thing started, I said, you can't doctor us the way you would someone in the real world, because this is going to go against every principle you have as a doctor.
Yeah.
Like and your job, though, is not to say don't run. Your job is to say, okay, we need to do this so you can run. Because we tried, like, when my guys were laying on the ground with IVs, the doc got all pissed off at me, and he's like, you know, you can't keep running in this heat. So I'm like, okay, let's switch
can
the night.
Yeah, where
switch the night running?
How about turn the heat down?
So we switched the night running.
I have to do this, yeah.
Right? So we get the miles in at night for a couple of nights, but guess what?
Now your sleep's
we got to sleep
up, yeah.
During the day, and it's 140 friggin' degrees.
Yeah, totally.
And it's not like we had an air-conditioned RV.
Yeah,
like
right.
I did not see an ice cube for 111 days, like not one.
Yeah.
So there was not a cold drink to be had. There was not anything. So we, but again, the I'll tell you something else that's interesting. So like I had my favorite stat of the entire time is I had two showers in 111 days. So, but what's funny is when you're all in this, and I would never in a million years compare this to like military, because my life may have been slightly at risk from time to time, you know, it's still child's play. I could basically quit whenever I wanted. So it's, and nobody was shooting at me.
Right.
But what what guys talk about, especially in women in the military, when they're in a firefight or when they're really in the shit for weeks or months at a time, the bonding that takes place, mm-hmm. and just the, and even in a gym, you know, when you're trying to reach a certain goal and you're doing it with other people and you're all on that same page, and there's a power to that that is just unmistakable. And that's what we found out there was this. It was us,
yeah.
You know, it was just the three of us and nobody else on the planet. And every single day, all I had was my stupid iPod playing the same freaking songs over and over, which I wrote Apple a letter after that expedition and said, look, I hit shuffle. Yet when I got home, you know, Johnny Cash, Ring of Fire played 48 times, you know, and this other song only played 3. Why is that? No, but awesome. You know, but it was tedious. You know, we ran 12 hours a day.
Was the mental part
of it was just impossible.
Yeah. Were the other guys running with you the whole time, or like, were they rotating?
No relay. Our vow was to stay together, and of course it made it harder because you're only as fast as your slowest person at any given moment.
Right. And that's why I'm running Vantage tomorrow.
Use it as an excuse. You say, I could go faster, but, you know,
I'm trying
to support my friend. So, but look, the best, because I don't want to forget to say this, you know, the best thing that came out of that expedition was Matt Damon and I started a nonprofit that was a clean water nonprofit at the time called H2O Africa, and today it's called water.org. And if you ever see Matt like on an advertisement, he did a bunch of Stella Artois has a big deal with water.org these days. And you know, so water.org is the biggest and most important water nonprofit in the world at this point, and it all came out of this just stupid idea to run across the Sahara Desert. And
crazy what happens when you start talking about things.
Yeah. And you know, and it came from some guy I'd never met before. And I always like to say, you know, words, you know, said to us in passing by a total stranger can change the course of your life if you're paying attention.
I can't believe they're using Matt Damon as the spokesperson instead of you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a much more successful fundraiser than he is. No, he's a great – I mean, the cool thing about him is he's really a good guy.
Yeah.
You know, like he's not a pretender, and he genuinely is involved in the nonprofit, and he's, you know, he's got a good heart. He's not doing it just for PR. I mean, the guy doesn't need any more PR.
Yeah.
So. What exactly does that organization do?
So in essence, it is an aggregator. It does two things. It provides funding for some other nonprofits that do clean water, but it's also about, you know, they've taken on the model of doing basically mini loans. So it's twofold. So they literally loan money, which in a lot of the countries, you know, in India, in a lot of African countries, you know, if you were to loan someone, you know, $100 to start a business, whatever that might be, you know, a roadside stand or whatever, it's an immense amount of money and more than enough to get them started. And so these micro loans help people who just can't possibly find a way out. The other big thing is it's not just about clean drinking water. It's about sanitation. It's about toilets. You know, it's about girls being able to go to school in a lot of these countries, because if you don't have a bathroom to be able to use, you know, at a school, if you don't have sanitation and some running water, then you really can't go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, certainly girls can't go. So the most important work that water.org does is providing those kind of opportunities in some of the most impoverished places on the planet.
If people want to support that organization, is there an easy way to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Water.org. It's, if you go there is and they probably get some very big corporate sponsorships, but more than 50% of the many millions of dollars they take in are from just individual donations of, you know, 25 or 50 or 100 bucks. And you know, and if you do all the you can do the checking. There's all kinds of charity sites out there that will rank charities, and you'll see water.org, you know, at or very near the top of, you know, responsible spending. Nobody's, you know, Matt Damon certainly isn't taking a salary. Let's put it that way. And nobody else, you know, there's nobody running it that's making, you know, $500,000 a year. You know, you got people who are committed to the cause. And, you know, that's the life that they had.
Yeah.
So, again, I always like to say, I mean, I get the great benefit of having been part of something that does the people who are drinking clean water or you know, having toilets or whatever, you know, they're not they don't know who I am, that's for sure. And, you know, I was getting ready to say they're not thinking about me when they're flushing the toilet, but maybe they are. I don't know. A lot of people are.
So at what point during your 5,000-mile run through the biggest desert on the planet, did you feel like, okay, I've made a horrible decision. This isn't gonna happen. I'm about done. Did you get to that point?
Yeah, it was really early on. I mean, to be honest, but I will freely admit, as just a, I don't know if I'm normal or not, but normally enough to be embarrassed and be, I was horrified about, I mean, this was a very big budget project and one that was in great danger of failure early on. And what I had to do actually was to take a step back after that first week and realize that I had been doing what we're all guilty of sometimes. You start a business and in your mind you're already spending all this money that you're going to make, even though that if that ever happens, it's a long way down the road. Mm-hmm. And I had to get it back to
you guys. That's the carrot. Yeah.
You guys look at each other. Yeah. And so, you know, and so.
Been there.
And right.
I know about that one.
So I started running in Senegal. Yeah. And I can tell you, I had this heroic vision of me diving into the Red Sea at the finish, right? And mm-hmm. just all the amazing things that were going to happen. Yeah. Well, guess what? I actually needed to do the work in between. Yeah. And so, like, on day 10, I finally understood that what I needed to do was get up and focus on the next day. So I got up and this is going to sound kind of crazy, but I got up the next day and I focused on just running a marathon in the morning. And I got to lunch. And that was my saying, get to lunch, you know, and I'd get to lunch and I'd have a break and a short little nap and I'd get up and I'd say, okay, all I have to do is run another marathon this afternoon.
It seems so easy. Just run the marathon.
Just 200 more marathons.
But it is funny, like on days when you guys are training, like maybe two times or even three times in a day, if you're focused on the dread that you have for the third workout or whatever it is you got going on, you're just screwing yourself.
There's a very cool athlete mindset that happens where it's like, oh, I just have to go work out.
Yeah.
A lot of people like look at it as like, oh, I got to go to the gym and I have to work out. I got to go run today. Like, it's like, no. I get to go do this.
Right.
It's awesome. This is where I'm. This is my happy place. I get to go find out how much better I can get today. Like, it's leading somewhere.
Yeah. And we all understand. I think the three of us get, and a lot of people listening understand that the hardest thing to ever do is to make the commitment or is to get out the door on any given day. Like the hardest. I love to run. I love to run. But you know what I do? I actually listen to podcasts when I run these days. So I do. It's weird. I actually look forward to it. Like, I don't let myself sit around the house and listen to podcasts. Like, I say if I'm going to listen, it's going to be while I'm running. So I need to get busy.
I can't listen to anything if I'm just sitting. If audiobooks, podcasts, anything of the sort, if I'm just sitting, I can't pay attention to it.
Same here.
No matter how hard I try, I daydream. Yeah. But if I'm like driving my car or making a meal or going for a run or working out, like then I can listen no problem.
Absolutely.
I've heard that about, on similar notes, something you just said, I've heard that about Navy SEAL training, like you're going through buds, you're going through Hell Week. The guys that can make it through, they tend to have two qualities. I'm sure there's more to it than this, but we can probably ask Mark Devine. He's walking around. He'll know better than I will. But the two main qualities that seem to help people get through is like the guys that can just focus on one evolution at a time, and they don't think like, fuck, I got four more days of no sleep, and they're not thinking about the future and all the stuff coming up. They're just thinking about like one foot in front of the next, one step at a time, and they're more present in that moment, and they don't get overwhelmed because they're just doing whatever is next, tend to do really well. And the guys that can, under extreme physical stress, still have an appetite and they're able to eat enough calories to keep going. The guys that get stressed and they can't eat, they fall apart.
Well, even tomorrow, you guys are going to experience, you're going to be out there long enough where, you know, you need to have at least a small plan for calories. Because you're gonna run out.
Incredibly unprepared.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be a lot.
Incredibly,
it doesn't
unprepared.
Have to be a lot. You know, normally for cardio, whatever, you know, you probably need 200, 250 calories an hour. So it's not a lot. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you had there's stuff out on the course, or if you even take a couple small snacks with you, like that's enough. Yeah. But if you don't have that, you're almost certainly gonna crash if you're trying to go hard. So.
Right.
But I know we don't have a lot more time, so
if we don't care about other people.
they can wait.
I have no interest in worrying about
exactly.
someone else's show. We haven't even gotten to the real reason we wanted to bring up the Sahara. Because go ahead, what do you got?
Oh, I was gonna ask more about the Sahara race. Like at the end, you know, what was that feeling like to actually finish and be like, holy shit, I did it?
Yeah. You know what? That's such a great question. I don't get to answer it very often. Do you know the predominant feeling I had was absolute sadness.
Oh, really?
Which is like it's over. Thing.
So, like you brought up the thing about the guys that go to a war and they're in these like really intense situations. If you watch, I'm like a documentary junkie because I love watching people go through these things. And if you watch like Restrepo, where these guys are in this like super gnarly environment, they're getting shot at every day, and then they're faced with either the most extreme violence or the most extreme boredom. And you think, God, I would love to get out of this environment. And what's the number one thing that almost every single one of them wants when they get home? They want to go back.
Yeah.
Because you can't find that bond with people. And there's nowhere else in your life that you're going to be in such an extreme situation where you have to rely on everyone around you to survive and like thrive in an environment that is literally there to kill you.
Real life is complicated. You know, interestingly, the Sahara was not complicated. I mean, there were complications. And, you know, if you see the film, you know, there were personalities. You know, I was both the like bad guy and the good guy. You know, I was the driving force and people didn't like how hard I pushed. And that's part of the film and it's part of the journey. But, you know, they, to a man, will say, you know, we would not have made it if someone hadn't been the guy, like, saying, yes, we're getting up again tomorrow and we're doing this again.
Someone's got to push.
You know, and if there isn't that person. But it was, you know, the feeling at the end of it was, of course, you know, some of it was relief to have done it and to have, you know, accomplished this huge goal. But it was sadness. I mean, I just knew instinctively that even if we'd turned around the next day and run back across, it never would be the same. And it's like going back to what we were talking about earlier. And, you know, we're making some light of you guys, you know, all of us racing tomorrow and what it's going to be like and all. But the ability to find that place in your mind where you appreciate what you're going through and the hard, if you can find appreciation for the hard moments, that is such a skill to master. And when you're in the midst of, you know, life is about chaos and randomness. And if you can't find a way to look forward to chaos and randomness and find a way to thrive under those circumstances, it's not sound very judgmental saying this, but that's not a life I'm interested in. I don't want to know what's happening tomorrow.
Yeah. I want to mix it up.
Yeah. I want to learn.
Create some problems.
I want to learn and
we're creating a massive problem for yourself again. You got a big adventure coming up.
I do. So I've had this is an idea that quite frankly is almost 10 years in the making.
You just started talking about it again.
Yeah.
Screwed yourself up. Now you got to go do it.
I did. And it's called, I mean, basically it's Dead Sea to Everest. So I'm going to go from the lowest place on the planet to the highest point on the planet.
So awesome.
Human powered.
Yeah.
And I'm literally going to swim to the middle of the Dead Sea. And I'm going to do a free dive in the Dead Sea to actually add a little bit of elevation loss to the lowest place that I'm going to go.
In the Dead Sea, though, you're going to dive like 12 feet.
It's hard.
Like,
it's hard to get under the water, actually. So,
But your skin also will like melt in that thing, right?
I'm hoping I can get 100 feet. We'll see. And
free dive?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Come on.
Seriously.
How are you going to do that? Are you going to put some weights on?
I'm going to I'll have to cut the cinder block from my ankle. But then I'm going to swim back to shore.
Swimming through slime out there, like sludge.
It is. I'm going to swim back to shore and start running. And I'm going to run about 2,000 miles across the Arabian Desert. And so it's Jordan and Saudi Arabia. And there's an area called the Empty Quarter in Saudi Arabia that literally is like the emptiest nothing place on the planet. And when I get to Oman, I'll run to the tip of Oman and I'm going to get into a kayak and I'm going to paddle 1,000 miles across the Indian Ocean to
nice little triathlon
to Mumbai. Right. And so when I get to Mumbai, India, I'm going to get on a mountain bike and I'm going to bike all the way across India to Western Nepal and then cut across east to Everest Base Camp and then climb to the top. And I call the project 5.8 because even though it's about 4,500 miles point to point, it's actually only 5.8 vertical miles from the Dead Sea to the top of Everest. And as I like to remind people, you know, I'm an environmentally conscious person. I'm someone who spends enough time outdoors to understand that we need to do a better job of being stewards of this place we live. But because that 5.8 space, we're all in it. You, whether you want to be along on my project, you're already in it, because every human being on the planet lives within that tiny little sliver of space that surrounds this earth, and we need to do a better job of just taking care of it. And
how long is it going to take you to do this?
This one is going to be, obviously, including, you know, a minimum of 6 weeks on Everest, will be about 4.5 months total. So, and it's a bigger idea even. I'm actually going to go from the lowest point to the highest point on all 7 continents. So this journey begins in January of 2019, actually in South America. So I'm going to go from the lowest place in South America is in Argentina, and so is the highest point. And they're separated by about 1,500 miles. And so I'm going to do a version of this on all 7 continents.
Have you thought about dying out there before?
You know, I have. Sure, I have, and my wife isn't, you know, my kids are grown at least, but they are both adventurers themselves and have come to this, you know, this. They understand that for me to be a whole and complete person and to be a good dad and a good husband and a moderately fully functioning person, I need to do these things. And I tell people all the time, I'm intensely flawed still. I mean, this isn't.
Only like another hour. We're wrapping up. Too interesting.
This isn't like I understand that there's a part of me that still is trying to fill that gap, that hole, that thing that's missing.
I was
missing.
Gonna say, where does this come from? You've done however many.
What is enough?
What is it, like 30 plus years now of chasing this dragon?
And what will be enough? And I have no idea. And I hope I never find out.
Yeah.
You know, I don't. The difference is I no longer need to do it to prove anything to somebody else. And I'm not even trying to prove anything to myself. You know, what I view myself as a cultural explorer. I'm not going to cross, you know, thousands of people have climbed Everest. It's not like I'm doing something nobody's ever done. I mean, the thing that the way I'm doing it, I'm doing something that no one's ever done. But this idea that people think I love running. I don't love running. I love where running takes me. I love the people that I get to meet through running. I love stopping way more than I like.
There's
running.
A very odd, like, flow state feeling type thing that goes on with running. And it happens with anything that you practice a lot, where you wake up and you go, I'm going to go run a marathon this morning. That's a very small distance to you.
Yeah.
In a way that you can conceptually just see the marathon. It's easy.
Yeah.
And you have to put in thousands and thousands of hours before that becomes something that's like, oh, I just need to go run a marathon.
You know,
it's
what
so simple.
What I love about it, though, and you actually, it's a great way to wrap up because you just nailed it. I believe in one simple thing. It doesn't matter what happens to us. It only matters what we do about it. So I view it as my responsibility personally to put myself in situations that are going to be difficult because I don't know what the outcome is going to be. But I know that I am going to get to make a decision. I am going to have to react to something, to respond, to adapt.
Yeah.
And to not just be the same as I was. I mean, there's a lot of, we didn't even get to some crazy stuff that's happened in my life. There are things that have happened.
That guy's, who cares?
With diseases, with, you know, there's lots of things that we all see around us. I mean, most of the things that have happened to me, I've chosen to put myself, some people would even argue even as an addict that I chose that. I don't really buy into that. Some of that is just because that's who I am. That's how I was built. But it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. All that matters is what we choose to do about the things that happen.
I also think there's some weird stuff that happens with, like, risk analysis, right? Like, where you play is so far away from normal humans could ever imagine getting, but it's not that extreme for you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've pushed the extreme so far that you may be stepping out of your comfort zone 1 or 2 degrees, but this is, like, conceptually something that you can wrap your head around. Like, yeah, I can dive down 100 feet. Like, that sounds possible. It's really just, like, I need to keep moving in the direction, and I'll get there. And it's a lot safer than it sounds, probably.
Yeah. Well, there's inherent risk in everything, right?
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite people will say to me sometimes, you know, because, you know, 3 guys will die in the Chicago Marathon on a hot year, right? They'll say, you know, running, aren't you worried about that? And I'll say to them, I'm like, well, you know, like, did you hear that 5,000 people died on the sofa with their, remote control in their hands this weekend. Like, yeah. Fuck, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Sounds like a really boring way to go.
Well, that sounds dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you want to talk about danger. Try living that lifestyle instead of this one.
Yeah.
If I drop dead tomorrow on this mountain, which hopefully that ain't going to happen, but, you know, I don't want that to happen, and I hope nobody says, ooh, he went out the way he wanted, you know, because that's all bullshit. I don't want to go anywhere.
Yeah.
I got, like, at least 20 more years of this stuff
totally.
To do. And you know, and maybe longer. And I want to keep discovering things and learning new stuff and recognizing that I have a lot of growing to do.
Yeah, that's incredible. Man, I met the dude on the documentary that I watched. It took me 35 minutes to figure it out, but I got there.
Usually people recognize my voice.
So radical. Are you bringing a production company with you to go?
Absolutely.
Oh.
No, you're going to be along on this journey.
It's 2019. We wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't a camera.
You're going to have to decide. You're going to have to decide which part of this adventure that you're going to come along on.
Are you doing all seven of them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're gonna,
what are you going to do in Antarctica? What are you going to do
down there?
Well,
that's a complicated one because the lowest point in Antarctica is
actually
a long ways away from the highest.
Polar bears. They're not friendly. You got to watch out.
That's actually going to be a really hard
polar bears in Antarctica.
Shit.
Damn. They're on the other side.
End, North Pole.
You know, whatever.
Wherever.
There's something.
I think it actually, like the name Antarctica or like Arctos means bear in some capacity. So Antarctica.
No, there's ants.
No
that's
bears.
It. There's yeah. ants. No, there's yeah. killer ants down there.
Really?
No.
Oh, killer that would be awesome. I don't know. It's like some like 9-pound ants. You can tell me anything. I'm not going to that place. It's so cold. There's nothing there. No Starbucks
I'm not
in
looking,
Antarctica.
I'm not
the penguins are a problem,
that.
Though.
That one,
Penguins will get you.
They will come after you. All billion of them.
You think they're cool because they're all dressed up.
They're all huddled up together, though. You don't know what they're talking about there.
They stand so proper.
So you've got 4.5 months of hiking while swimming to 100 feet deep into all of it.
I just want to keep telling stories, man. So we're gonna, you know, there's a lot of production companies, and actually, Spartan is going to be involved in the project. So in the Dead Sea to Everest, the 5.8 project, Spartan is. We haven't even made
an
official
name,
announcement, but we're
fantastic name.
We're gonna be partners in this thing.
Killer.
So Joe DeSena has, you know. He recognizes it as something that is Spartan-esque, you know, and this idea of finding new things to do and new things to. I was going to use the word conquer, but I don't like that word because it you don't conquer anything. You might very briefly get on top of it, but then you got to find something else to do. So there's very little conquering. If you're lucky enough to get through it, then there's just something else to do.
Well, if you have any interest somewhere in the middle of this journey, you want to take a day off and come turn the microphones on. I'd
damn
love
right.
to interview you in the middle of this thing.
We won't. We'll use the sat phone, and you guys will just talk to me when I'm out there.
Let's do
we'll
that.
Do seriously.
Let's
100%.
Do it. I'll do that.
I can walk and talk.
Damn,
probably doesn't surprise
do
you.
I'm game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can people follow this journey? Find you. Find the trail run that we talked about an hour and a half ago. That is more.
Yeah,
immediate.
I'm on all social media. So and it's always just Charlie Engle, and my website is charlieengle.com. I'm sure it'll be in you guys.
Yep. Show notes.
Stuff. Show notes. And that's the best aggregator right now. There will be a specific site for the 5.8 series, but for now.
Is Matt Damon doing this thing?
He's not, although I'm actually talking to him about trying to
come
out. Yeah.
He's too scared.
I know. You know. Well, you know, he's...
like he's busy or something.
Yeah. Born.
Yeah. Boo. Jason Bourne can't even do what you're doing. You're a savage. Charlie Engle crushes Jason Bourne.
He's like, can I shoot something? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Okay. Can't come.
So charlieengle.com.
Yeah.
At Charlie Engle.
Man. Instagram's kind of the place I'm living these days more than anywhere else. So at, you know... The Charlie Engle Instagram.
And then how do people get signed up for the trail run?
Yeah, and so that just also look at my Instagram, but basically Spartan Trail. So spartantrail.com. It's going to be on the Spartan sites. This initial run in Virginia, we don't even have a dedicated site for it yet, but very soon people will start. Anybody who's ever gone to a Spartan site understands that you're going to be hit with about 1,000 ads after that anyway. So don't worry, we'll find you.
Yeah, like it.
That's true.
That's awesome, man.
Targeting is fantastic.
Yeah. Douglas Larson.
Yeah. You can find me on everything Strug Collective, Barbell Shrugs on Wednesdays. And often on Saturdays these days. I do technique wads every Sunday. You can check me out, Douglas, Douglas E. Larson on Instagram. Even though I've barely been posting lately, I've been trying to stay off of social media. It's negatively correlated with happiness, turns out. So I've been happier not being on my phone on social media so much lately, but occasionally I still post there.
We're actually doing real work, people.
That's true. I get way more
Instagram's
work done.
Instagram's for bored work. Like, I don't have shit to do right now, so I'll put a post up.
I'll show people how busy I am.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I launched my own site, kind of a catch-all site. If people want to work with me, you can go on there. I offer personal training, business, fitness consulting. I have digital products on nutrition, mobility, movement, things like that. You can go to DougLarsonFitness.com and check that out.
Killer. I'm at Anders Barner, getting in the Shrug Collective. 6 shows a week, 1 million downloads a month. Come and hang out with us.
Yeah.
Dude,
like
this was so sad, doesn't it?
I know, right?
Yeah, it's so savage.
It's months in a row.
Two commas, people. We're doing
it.
Man, this is super.
Can I come on again next week?
Yeah, you can come on all the time.
I need to sell
Dude,
some
I feel
stuff.
Like if we really want to piss some people off, I have no problem with it, especially on our first interview. We'll just walk over and tell Dan, like, screw this. We're not doing another one. We could go another hour and a half.
We're staying on.
I have so many things to talk to you about.
Yeah.
You do weird shit. I want to hear about all the diseases and like what happens out on in the desert.
I'll tease the next.
This is actually like what I do. I close the show and then we go another half hour.
I'm gonna tease the next time you're gonna have me on. So I've spent some significant time in prison. So we'll talk about that next.
Really?
Time. So, yeah.
Shut up.
Yeah.
We got to the end of the show. Then you drop that bomb.
No, hold
you
on. Know? I'll tell Dan. Out. Oh man.
All right. We'll do it next time.
This is awesome. Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Wonderful.
Thanks, Charlie.
See you guys on Wednesday.
All right.